I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rachel Laser, Executive Director, Americans United for Separation of Church and State. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our new Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our Shinshinim Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri, and our final visit from Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom, Chag Sameach, and Happy Passover. Today is the second day of Pesach, the week-long festival of freedom and matzah, although there are certainly some Jews who believe Passover begins and ends with a Seder. For Reform Jews and all Jews in Israel, Pesach actually lasts 7 full days. For conservative and Orthodox Jews outside of Israel, Passover lasts 8 full days, which means more opportunities to eat that bread of no leaven, that flat baked dough of intestinal affliction, matzah. During the springtime Passover Festival of Freedom, we Jews are commanded not to eat anything leavened, including especially bread. That means more matzah for everyone. And as anyone who's ever listened to Two Jewish at this time of year knows, your host, me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is no fan of matzah. Before I say any more about matzah, you must know that I love most Jewish food. This Pesach, for the very first time, I made chicken soup and matzah balls from scratch by myself, enough to serve 40 or so people over 2 seders, made 2 successful raisin apple apricot cinnamon kugels, and so far, nobody has died from my cooking. Charoset in its many variations is a personal specialty of my limited culinary skills. In the non-Passover sphere, hamantaschen and latkes compete on my palate for the title of all-time favorite Jewish food. A great challah is a true taste of heaven, and I even enjoy gefilte fish, while Sephardic and Oriental Jewish specialties, with their liberal use of spice and rose water and other flavors of the East, are among the all-time delicacies I love. There are few Jewish foods I don't enjoy when they are well made. Ah, but matzah? Matzah is the signal exception. My one area of personal aversion, the one Jewish food I find painful and nearly inedible, is the one food we must eat in profusion this time of year, the ever-popular rendition of baked perforated cardboard, matzah, bread of true affliction. When the Israelites were given a choice between personal and religious freedom and eating only unleavened bread or staying in slavery, wow, that must have been a tough choice. I'm not sure I wouldn't have chosen slavery and decent bread. Well, I'll receive much criticism and emails professing shock that I can't stand matzah. How can I call myself a rabbi? And matzah with butter and salt is a fabulous foodstuff to eat. Frankly, anything with butter and salt tastes good, including newspaper and shirt cardboard, which matzah, of course, closely resembles. I mean, the French cook snails with butter and salt and claim they are edible. So, we Jews do the same thing with matzah. Perhaps my favorite Pesach joke is, what do you call someone who derives pleasure from the bread of affliction? A matzachist. Anyway, I annually complain so much about matzah before, during, and after Pesach that I've actually gotten into trouble over my anti-matzah bias. Manischewitz refuses to return my calls asking them to become sponsors of Two Jewish. Streitz's filed a complaint with the FCC alleging religious food bias. I have been banned from posting by the matzah support group chat room. And after much public criticism, Facebook is now looking into allegations that my anti-matzah advocacy has been sponsored by Vladimir Putin as part of a Russian government anti-Semitic plot. Well, bowing to all this unleavened pressure, I have to back off my distaste for the tasteless bread of culinary affliction or face the appointment of a special prosecutor. And so, to avoid this impending witch hunt, and as a bow to all those matzah advocates everywhere, and to play us in on this second morning of Pesach, here's a little more Passover music, one of my favorite takes on what matzah's really like. It's from the smoothie Eric Schwartz, a past guest of Too Jewish.
I feel like a freak, because every time I pull out something to eat, but it's weak, I can't do this, because I'm Jewish, and I can't eat bread. Yeah, my rabbi said only matzah. Any way you want to eat it, cold or hot, it's matzah. Fun for your mother, brother, sister, father, matzah. Buy in bulk for a lower cost per box, it's matzah, 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 matzah. Hanukkah, no, that's over, so you don't get Passover. I'm the mad flow, a smoothie demon with the jib and jabbing. If you want the story of Passover, rent the Ten Commandments, starring Charlton Heston. But I got a question about the bread.
That was Eric Schwartz talking about matzah on Passover, which we're commanded to eat on this festival of unleavened bread. Enjoy it, even if I don't. The separation of religion and state is a powerful part of the First Amendment and a central aspect of our American democracy, and it has been critical to our people's acceptance and success in the U.S. Our guest this morning is Rachel Laser, Executive Director, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and she'll explore this issue with us when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish Rachel Laser. She is the not quite brand new, but very recently named executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Previously, she was prominent at the Religious Action Center in Washington, D.C. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Very glad to be with you.
So tell us about your organization and the whole concept of separation in church and state, which seemed to be an inviolate part of, inviolable maybe, part of the United States Constitution and Bill of Rights, and yet has come into question increasingly.
Yes. Americans United for Separation of Church and State, which is the nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that I started leading a little over a month ago, is 71 years old. Actually, and it exists to advance the constitutional principle of separation of religion and government, which we believe is the only way to ensure freedom of religion and freedom of conscience for all Americans. So the 16 words in the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law concerning an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, has two parts, the non-establishment of religion part and the free exercise part, and we think that they are inextricably linked. So separation of religion and government ultimately is what protects the independence and integrity of religion, and vice versa for the government, so that we are operating according to American ideals and values and not one religion's ideals and values. And that's really what we're, that's what we're about.
You know, I'm going to address it from a Jewish perspective. That First Amendment has been so central to Jews' acceptance and experience in America. You would think that all Jews who understand that would support that provision. That isn't always the case, though, is it?
That is true. And as the first Jewish leader of Americans United, it feels especially important for me when I'm talking about the segment of the religious community, which isn't the entire religious community by any means, but the segment of the religious community that is seeking to destroy the separation of religion and government, that I do not just say it's conservative Christian, because it's not. It's certain segments, not all, of the Orthodox Jewish community, and certain segments of a variety of different communities, and really feels like it's fundamentally driven by more of a well-funded and coordinated politically conservative movement that is sort of using the issue of what they're defining as religious freedom, and we can talk more about that, as their cause celebre to advance a conservative political agenda more than a religious one.
We will talk much more with Rachel Laser, the executive director of the organization working for separation of church and state, Americans United for Separation of Church and State. When we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We're approaching the 70th birthday of the State of Israel, and as part of our build-up for this huge celebration, for the next weeks, Too Jewish will include spots from both our Israeli Shin Shinim and today both our Maven and Mivina on Israel. We welcome our Maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
So it's Pesach. Matzah is everywhere. Tell us on your tie today, which we're going to hold up to the microphone so everybody can see it. Tell us a little bit. By the way, that tie, if you put butter and salt on it, will taste just like matzah.
Of course.
Not quite as crunchy. Tell us about your experience of Pesach. What's your most memorable Passover experience in Israel growing up and or at any time in Israel?
So Pesach, you know, when I think about Pesach, it brings good memories. Unfortunately, some are a little bit sad, you know, so because you remember your grandparents.
Yes, of course.
And, you know, they're not alive now in my age. But Pesach was always a holiday that we got together. It was very simple when you were a child because you knew where you were going. You know, you were with your parents and grandparents. But then when you got married, it became a little bit difficult because it was like,
two
okay, this year.
And who do you go
right,
with?
Where do you go? You go to your in-laws, you go to your parents.
And in Israel,
you know,
really, it's one night of Seder, right? You don't
correct.
Have a second
only one,
night.
Only one, yeah. So I'm guessing, you know, some families, it's easy, an easy decision. Some is a little bit more complex. Yeah.
Interesting. So who had better food, your family or your wife's family?
I will stay politically correct. I will say both.
In Israel, Pesach is also vacation time from school, right?
Correct, yeah.
And so do people go away, you know?
So again, growing up, it was in Israel.
Right.
You know, everyone just went to the nature, hiked.
Go to the Galil.
Went to different families, to different friends in Israel, you know. It all depends, you know, where you come from, your family. You know, my dad really wanted us to get to know the country. So we hiked a lot and we went to the nature a lot.
It's a beautiful time of year,
it
of course, springtime.
It is beautiful. It's beautiful.
Wildfires,
I think after that, you know, it became that a small world, and the airfares became, you know, less expensive. People went out from Israel, you know, so to do the Seder in different places in the world.
Interesting. You know, some of that, of course, was the way that Israel changed over time.
Of course.
And became a more affluent country. You know, it wasn't so easy for Israelis to go anywhere. And then, of course, it became, because it's a small country and you can't exactly go into the neighboring countries very much.
No, you cannot.
You want to go everywhere else.
Right.
I do remember one Pesach in Israel, going to Turkey. That was one of the great destinations at the time from Israel. Maybe not so much anymore.
Yeah, it depends when.
Yeah, it depends on the politics.
Of course.
What's your favorite Pesach food?
There are two. One is a very simple one, which is a matzah with chocolate, the shachar, the Israeli chocolate.
The kosher for Pesach chocolate.
Kosher for Pesach.
The spread,
and yeah, spread, yeah, it's delicious, you know.
For breakfast,
and you don't eat it, yeah, and you don't eat it a lot, so you really wait for Passover to do that, Pesach. That's one. And the other one is matziah. I think you call it
matzah brei here.
Yes, the Yiddish, yes, yes. Uh-huh. That was like, you know, so my mom was the cook of the house. And like once a year, my dad had his specialty, which was that.
So it's he made the matzah brei, and yes. It's called matziah in Hebrew.
Correct, matziah, yes.
And I make
it to my children, you know, so it goes from generation to generation.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Amir. We'll talk next week. Chag Sameach.
Thank you. Chag Sameach v'kasher.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, Tamir Shakuri and Chen Denachi, our representatives of Israel here. So sports are obviously a huge part of America and American culture. They're a big part of Israeli culture, too. You've seen a little bit of the contrast between them this year.
Yeah. We both experienced the Super Bowl this year.
Right. A religious experience in America.
Yeah, it was a great experience. It was my first Super Bowl party. When you're in Israel, you do hear about the Super Bowl because you want to see what Israeli was in the commercials this year and like who won. That's the basic stuff.
Yeah, there were
stuff.
No Wonder Woman Gal Gadot commercials. I don't know how they missed that one.
He's being humble, but there was a Tamir cousin. One of his cousins was in the Febreze, whatever you call it, Super Bowl commercial.
Oh, you've got acting in the family.
Yeah. So it was just like it was really cool to see everyone gather together and watch sports for like 4 hours and watching commercials. Let's be honest, the commercials are very, very interesting.
Very entertaining. Yep.
Sometimes more entertaining. So it was a cultural experience for us.
So the only comparable sports event, I think, for Israel is the Euro Cup basketball final, which Israel's now won 5 or 6 times. Very unusual. Israeli success on the international athletic stage, not as great as we might hope.
Yep. Israelis have some strength. We're not bad at judo and right. With boats.
Sailing. Some sailing medals in the Olympics, that's right.
Uh-huh. And also basketball, we had some success in the past couple of years. We had David Blatt, which is an amazing coach that is right. Now coaching in the NBA.
He coached the Cavaliers for a while and mm-hmm. had won, an American who had won the Euro Cup 2 or 3 times, I think.
Yep. So NBA stole him away from us, but he won the championship with Israel twice.
Twice.
So it is an amazing accomplishment, and it just brought a lot of pride to Israel. I would watch the game with my dad every Thursday. We would gather in the living room and watch the game with popcorn, no matter how late it was. It was just fun.
So now I understand that the finals would fall sometimes at a very inopportune moment.
A lot of times, I think about 3 times that I remember, the EuroLeague finals was on Yom Kippur.
Of course.
Of course, because where else can you put it? It was just before we started fasting. So my dad and I would sit in the living room with our like synagogue clothes.
Your white clothes for Yom Kippur, clothes, right?
And we would look at a TV and scream. And then if Yom Kippur entered, we would just turn off the TV, go to synagogue and hope no one spoils who won and who lost.
Right.
But it was just, I think it was a good thing for Israel to have a sports team that is a pride for Israel because we're known to be good in sports when it comes to us, but then when you compare it to the world, you see that
it's a small country, maybe not quite as good as we hope. I will say, I happened to be in Israel just by chance when Israel won its first EuroLeague title, and the whole country went nuts. This is in the 1970s. It was a huge upset. And ever since then, basketball, kadrosal, has been such a huge part of Israeli culture. Thank you so much, guys. Oh, wait.
And I dance.
Thank you so much for participating. We'll talk next week.
Talk to you next week.
We're exploring Israel's 70th anniversary, 310 years to be biblical, with a new Two Jewish feature, a look at each decade of Israel's existence from 1948 to 2018 through a headline from that year or decade, and a signature melody as well. So this morning, we continue the process of reviewing the history of the Jewish state, 70 years of Israel in 7 weeks, on to decade three, with a headline from, well, close to 1968. While 1968 was a critical year in America, 1967 was the defining year for Israel, with incredibly important implications for the next 50 years of the then still young Jewish state. Our headline comes from the June 8, 1967 Washington Post. It reads, "Israel routs Arabs, frees Gulf, truce in Jordan, Egypt defiant." This came on the fourth day of the Six-Day War, a stunning period of less than a week, in which Israel went from a tiny, critically endangered Jewish state encircled by advancing enemies to a regional superpower. The buildup to the war began in May 67, when Egypt advanced its armies across the Sinai Peninsula to the very borders of Israel and blockaded Eilat, while the Syrians shelled Israeli kibbutzim in the Galilee and Jordan signed a mutual defense pact with Egypt. On June 5, 1967, Israel destroyed the Egyptian Air Force while it sat on the tarmac, then turned and did the same thing to the Syrian Air Force. In lightning strikes against the massive and fully mobilized but terribly led Egyptian army, Israel captured the Gaza Strip and then the entire Sinai, all the way through Sharm el-Sheikh at the far southwestern tip. The Egyptians fled, leaving behind their armor and supposedly their shoes. Against Israel's strong insistence, King Hussein then had the Jordanian army attack, and in a sudden burst, Israel defeated them, captured the entire West Bank, and in some hard fighting, the old city of Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, and the Western Wall. Turning next to Syria, which believed false reports from Egypt of Arab victory and shelled Israel, Israeli air power and armored units and infantry, including the legendary Golani Brigade, captured the Golan Heights and drove the Syrian army back nearly to Damascus in little more than a day. By the time the UN, heavily influenced by the USSR and the United States, brokered a ceasefire, on June 10, 1967, Israel had captured territory that multiplied its size dramatically, humiliated its enemies, and established itself as the preeminent power in the Middle East. Most importantly, Israel captured the holy old city of Jerusalem and returned it to our people forever. Har Habayit Biyadenu, it said, "The Temple Mount is in our hands." Yitzhak Rabin was chief of staff of the Israeli Armed Forces, the IDF, and was given the honor of naming this dramatic war. He chose a name both prosaic, like himself, but that also evoked the very creation of the world, the Six-Day War. Israel was changed forever. A great spirit of optimism pervaded the once tiny, struggling country. The kibbutz became a place every young person around the world, Jewish or not, wanted to come and experience the incredible energy of this young nation. No longer did people live in daily terror the country would be swallowed up by the surrounding Arab enemies, at least for a while. The impact of the Six-Day War cannot be overstated on Israel, both positively and as an ongoing challenge. 1 million Arabs fell under the control of the Israeli military in less than a week, and the territories that the Arab nations squandered away in a disastrous attack on Israel have become places of tremendous contention for the past half century. But East Jerusalem, the old city, that's different. Our song from 1967 is the most important Israeli song ever, probably one of the most beautiful and still popular today. We have told its story in detail here on Too Jewish before, but it bears repeating. Written by preeminent Israeli songwriter Naomi Shemer, it debuted just before the war, sung by a teenage girl singer, Shuli Natan, a past guest of Too Jewish. She performed it in a show in Western Jerusalem at the Binyanei HaUma, and it quickly became wildly popular, its lyrics about the beautiful city of gold waiting lonely for her children to return. Immediately after the war, Naomi Shemer penned a new verse about the joyous return of the city's Jewish children. Here is Yerushalayim Shel Zahav from 1967.
נישא ברוח ארבעים עם כל פעמונים ובתרדמת אילן ואבן שבויה בחלומה העיר אשר בדד יושבת ובליבה חומה ירושלים של זהב ושל נחושת ושל אור עלו לכל שירייך אני כינור ירושלים של זהב ושל נחושת ושל אור עלו לכל
That was our third weekly Two Jewish celebration of 70 years of Israel in 7 weeks, a memory from the headlines of 1967, the decade of the 1960s. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach, Aziz and Pesach, all of that stuff. Passover, the great ultimate festival of freedom, brings Jews together, but also divides us in some ways.
Right. Well, we all observe Passover as one of our most central holidays. And it's, you know, we're reminded every Friday night when we make Kiddush of remembering the Exodus from Egypt.
Right.
And Pesach is a time we devote a whole week to doing that. And the Seders, whether we have one in Israel or two in the diaspora or whatever, our whole evening's dedicated to thinking about notions of freedom and the birth of our nation and the exodus from Egypt and all that. But as we both know very well, Jews around the world have developed such different customs and different traditions, not only in terms of what we eat, the famous gefilte fish line that we once talked about, north of which it's salty and south of which it's sweet, but also...
Well, not to mention, you know, the Sephardim and Edot HaMizrach, Eastern communities that don't even think gefilte fish is food.
Right, exactly. And so, I mean, only in certain cases is gefilte fish even remotely associated with the Passover Seder. Charoset is unrecognizable. In some places, it's almost liquid, it's blended, it's pounded.
It's made out of tropical fruits. It's made out of all kinds of things. Right,
with no apples and no walnuts and no pecans.
Right.
I mean, so... You know, my grandmother's very basic charoset, which was red apples, pecans, cinnamon, and Mogen David sweet wine, was what most American Jews think of as charoset. But around the world, there's a million variations, including something dark and jam-like that is basically fig paste with crushed walnuts in it.
Or Moroccan date balls that they serve, and there's lots of great ones. I make a good one of those, by the way.
Right. So, I mean, it's interesting that Pesach, in some ways, is the most popular holiday. It brings the family together around the table for a prolonged period. There's games for kids. In some parts of the world, people use little plastic animals for the 10 plagues, frogs and spiders and other things, and they throw them around, and it's really meant to be a holiday for all the generations. And there's the recurrent theme that in every generation, you're obliged to think that you yourself were brought out of Egypt by God. Right. And so that is a commonality of Pesach around the world, but the foods, the tunes, the way the table looks, what you interpret as karpas, for example. I mean, we generally use like parsley or cilantro or something. Other places use romaine lettuce leaves. I mean, it's wildly different, almost unrecognizable, yet it, like Shabbat and other things, have bound Jews together as a nation, regardless of where they live and regardless of how differently they celebrate it and how different the foods look and taste and how different the tunes sound. It somehow unites us more than it divides us.
Absolutely, and may it continue to do so from this Passover till next year in Jerusalem.
Kein Yehi Ratzon.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivina on Israel, Oshrat Bariel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So you did me a terrible disservice. You introduced me to a TV show on Netflix and now also on YouTube called Fauda, which is about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's really about counterterrorism in the territories. And it is incredible. And the disservice was, as soon as I watched the first one, I was stuck. And I binge-watched the entire first season and got nothing done. So it's an incredible show. Let's talk about it. And by the way, it's all subtitled. It's easy to follow. There's even some English in it for American audiences. I think it's incredible.
I think it shows, you know, before that it will show to the world what's the conflict all about? It shows the Palestinian and the Israelis. It's a rare opportunity for us Israelis to see the other side and not from the headlines. It sounds crazy, right? We're living it next to each other. But we never think of a terrorist as a human being who can love his wife so much and can risk his life only to give her a perfume.
Children.
Yeah, mamash. And you never think of, you know, the Israeli soldiers that can be so nasty to at a checkpoint. You know, you live in like very dichotomic, like kind of black and white. You know, those are bad and those are maybe not bad or good.
Just diachronic, like
and
it's good
and after
bad,
you watch bad, these 12 episodes and then the second season.
Don't tell me about the second season.
I won't tell you that Walid was killed. I won't tell you.
No spoilers.
But after you see it, you understand that the goods are not always goods and the bads are not always bads and goods can be bads and bads can be... And you know, it confuses you and it makes you really... First of all, you enjoy the show.
That's a great show. It's
definitely.
Yeah.
It's done beautifully.
It's so intense.
Yes. But it also makes you think. And what makes me as an Israeli really, really love it, that I know that those, the two who wrote the script, both of them were soldiers in one of these Mistar Vim unit. I don't know how to say it, but this elite unit.
Counterterrorism, the elite counterterrorism.
Elite unit. So yeah. You know that, and what makes it so intense that you know that some of it, I don't know if 5% or 100%, you know, probably happen. So that's what makes you really like...
So I'm going to ask you a difficult question. You know, you lost your father to a terror attack. I mean, this is something that strikes very close to home. It must be extremely difficult to see it through this lens, and yet you love it, the show.
I love it, and on a personal conversation, I told you something that I don't know if you were able to process it, that I was able to really be empathetic with... I know it sounds awful to those who didn't see the TV show yet.
Right.
But it really, I was empathetic with the terrorist, you know, on the first season.
Because they're human beings.
I was able to understand where he comes from. And I don't know. I don't know if it sounds good or not, but that's what I felt. And I'm not embarrassed with it. And I hope that every Israeli that will, and I know from hearing other people and
it's
the reviews.
Oh
my God. And the reviews that everyone sees, like, oh my God, I see the reality in a different lens.
Through a different lens.
And
it's an incredible show. It's called Fauda, F-A-U-D-A. If you can find it on Netflix, if you have that, and if you don't, you should get it or watch it on YouTube. It's an incredible show.
Yeah.
And it helps us see everyone as a human being, flawed, complete, remarkable show.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for showing it to me, even if I did lose all the time watching it.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thanks, Ashra. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. This time, a Passover classic. A blind man sits on a park bench during Pesach. The rabbi sits down next to him, takes out his lunch, including some Pesach matzah. Seeing the blind man has nothing to eat and taking pity on him, the rabbi takes a piece of matzah and gives it to the blind guy. A couple moments later, the blind man turns, taps the rabbi on the shoulder and says, "Who wrote this garbage?" You see, matzah has raised bumps all over it and the blind guy thought it was Braille and... forget it. Anyway, that was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and enjoy that matzah. And now a word of Torah. This coming Shabbat, we encounter a bit of conflict over Torah portions. If you're a conservative or Orthodox Jew outside the land of Israel, you'll be celebrating the eighth day of Pesach, the extra day required in the diaspora, and have a festival reading for Passover. If you're a Reform Jew or live in the land of Israel, you'll read the Torah portion of Shmini from Leviticus. The two cycles rejoin in a few weeks, but for now, we'll read different Torah portions. More Torah for everybody, I guess. For those of us reading the non-Passover portion, this week's Sedra is the third in the book of Leviticus Shmini, and it includes a very dramatic and traumatic event. The tabernacle in the wilderness has just been consecrated, and the priests, Moses' brother Aaron and his sons, are entering their office. God's presence fills the tabernacle. All is well with the people. And then, suddenly, disaster strikes. Aaron's eldest sons, newly ordained priests, named Nadav and Avihu, offer what is called Esh Zarah, strange fire to the Lord. They are immediately struck down and devoured by divine fire, dying before the Lord. In the aftermath of this tragic shock, Moses consoles Aaron with these strange words. God says, "By those brought near to me, I am consecrated and honored before the people." There is no word on whether Aaron accepted this as somehow a just ending for his sons. The text merely says, "Vayidom Aharon." Aaron was silent. We do not know the young priest's offense, if there was any. We are not told what that strange fire was. God decrees, and atonement offerings are made for whatever sin was committed, and the people are restored in God's favor. We also do not know why certain tragedies take place or why terrible things sometimes happen to good people. As Ben Sirach says in the text Ecclesiasticus from the Apocrypha of the Bible, we have been shown more than we can understand. We do know that Aaron's silence may be the only real response to profound tragedy and loss. And our comfort may come only when we silently acknowledge our own powerlessness. This may be small comfort indeed, but it is also an honest appraisal of our ability to comprehend profound loss. May God keep us from such tragedies, but may God also give us the strength of Aaron when we have to face them. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rachel Laser, the new executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, will explain how her organization works for freedom of religion, why that's important for Jews, when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Over 10,000 people participated in a memorial march in Paris for an 85-year-old Holocaust survivor burned and found dead with 11 stab wounds in her apartment last week. Many of the marchers were Jews. Some wore Israeli flags at the March for Muriel Knoll. The march was covered heavily by French media and provided encouragement for French Jews who in the past have felt ignored by their government. Knoll was murdered by her Muslim neighbor in a horrifying anti-Semitic hate crime last week. Holocaust survivor Nicole Friedman said that she came to the march because I'm Jewish, because I lived through the war. Flanked by her daughter, Friedman marched slowly with the aid of a cane. Another marcher, Alain Digal, wore an Israeli flag. Digal is of African descent and not Jewish. I came because this barbarity concerns us all, the 48-year-old said. Meanwhile, the appearance of Marine Le Pen, head of France's far-right National Front Party, caused a scuffle. Dozens of her supporters shouted, "Marine is with us," while others shouted, "N for Nazi," referencing the first letter of her party's name in French. The head of the French Jewish communities, Francis Califat, said that neither leaders from the National Front nor the insubmissible France far-left movement were welcome due to their history of anti-Semitism. Jean-Luc Mélenchon, head of the insubmissible France, also attended the march, ignoring Califat's call. Earlier that same day, French President Emmanuel Macron attended Knoll's funeral in the Paris suburb of Bagneux. He wore a kippah and spoke with Knoll's friends and relatives. Knoll's attacker murdered an innocent and vulnerable woman because she was Jewish. In doing so, they profaned our sacred values and our history, Macron said at the funeral. In other news, we have two stories about keeping kosher this week. Some Israeli hospitals have decided to ignore a request from the chief rabbinate to have security guards at their entrances check employees and visitors for chametz, leavened products, during Passover. An NGO, a non-governmental organization called Secular Forum, challenged the chief rabbinate's guidelines, which were supported by the Israeli Health Ministry, in a petition to the Israeli Supreme Court. The Health Ministry does not require the restriction legally, but hospitals have been reluctant to flout the rabbinate's request out of fear that they would lose their kashrut certification. The Israeli Supreme Court has yet to rule on the petition, but initially called the chametz ban a reasonable restriction. Previous years, signs placed at the hospitals asked people entering to refrain from bringing in leavened products, chametz. Guests were asked to leave such products at the front desk and pick them up on their way out. You know, a full-body search for secret chametz when you walk into a hospital does not seem to embody the Jewish festival of freedom, now does it? And finally, bacon may be kosher one day, and cheeseburgers too, provided they do not originally come from a living animal. A startling story circulated last week saying that a prominent rabbi had stated that cloned pig meat would be kosher for consumption by Jews, including when eaten with dairy products. Rabbi Yuval Chirlo of the Tzohar Rabbinical Organization in Israel said that cloned meat is not subject to the rules that apply to the consumption of regular meat. Chirlo, might be Chirlo, was quoted saying that cloned meat produced from a pig shall not be defined as prohibited for consumption, including with milk. The Tzohar Rabbinical Organization is a group of 800 modern Orthodox Zionist rabbis. The issue appears to be a kashrut question about meat grown artificially in a laboratory from the cells of a pig, not meat produced from a live pig whose genetic material comes from a cell from which the pig was cloned. At a Bar-Ilan University symposium titled Science and Halacha, featuring a talk by Rabbi Chirlo, he advocated rabbinic approval of cloned meat so that people would not starve, to prevent pollution, and to avoid the suffering of animals. When the cell of a pig is used and its genetic material is utilized in the production of food, the cell, in fact, loses its original identity and therefore cannot be defined as forbidden for consumption, Chirlo said. It wouldn't even be meat, so you can consume it with dairy. 5 years ago, back in 2013, Rabbi Menachem Ganak, CEO of the Definitive Orthodox Union's Kosher Division and a past guest of Too Jewish, said that meat from a lab-grown hamburger could be consumed with dairy products, although halacha, religious law, forbids it in meat produced from a real animal. But Ganak, who was commenting on the production of an artificial hamburger produced by researchers from Maastricht University in the Netherlands, did not mention pork, whose consumption is, of course, one of Judaism's strongest prohibitions. Without prophesying, clearly there will be a major disagreement, Chirlo said, over the consumption of cloned meat, for sure. And while there is merit in prohibiting this meat too, halachic thought should examine the needs of all humanity, not only one's own case, he said. You know, it may be a while before you find cloned meat in your local supermarket or the butcher shop, but trust me, it'll happen someday, and the kosher authorities will be there to argue about it. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Rachel Laser is the executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, the first Jewish director, I should note. She was the deputy director of the Religious Action Center in Washington, D.C., a very important arm of the Reform Jewish Movement's work on political equality in America. She is a graduate of Harvard and the University of Chicago Law School. I'm sorry you couldn't get into better schools. It's very disappointing to your parents, I'm sure. I want to come back to the question of separation of church and state and how the First Amendment is so defined. What are there have been different ways of thinking about that over American history, including times when a great deal more religion was present in public discourse than it is now, and times when there was less. Is this just a cyclical thing? Is there something else going on now?
Right now, there is a conservative political movement that has decided to front and center this theme of the endangerment of what they're calling religious freedom and religious liberty. as a way of calling folks to action behind their politically conservative agenda. And that is a very sort of time-centric piece of what we're experiencing right now with the ascendance of this theme of, you know, the quote, endangerment of religious freedom. I would argue, actually, that what this political conservative movement is doing is causing great danger to the very principle that they are seeking to, quote, defend. And it's true that,
No, I was just going to say, I mean, there have been different phases of this, you know, the war on Christmas stuff. By the way, I'm thinking about starting a movement against the war on Passover, because donut shops, they open through the whole week. It's really, really not fair. Sorry, I know it's not just a trivial issue, but there was a moral, there was a silent moral majority movement in the 70s. This does come up. What's different about this kind of approach now?
Not sure that it's so different, except that, you know, this is a moment where our leadership in the country and our administration is so completely lockstep with this political conservative movement strategy around destroying the separation of religion and government. And that makes it a particularly dangerous moment for this country. So I think that is something that is unique about the moment we're living in right now.
What does your organization do in working towards continuation of the separation of church and state?
So many things. We work on the legal front, which I'm really proud of. We have a very robust legal department that is involved in lawsuits around the country in order to hold our country accountable to this principle of the separation of religion and government. Right now, just as one of our many lawsuits, I'll give you an example. We have a lawsuit against the school system in the Bossier Parish in Louisiana, which is proselytizing Christianity in its schools, requiring its coach requiring football players to pray before football games, requiring entire auditoriums of families to say a Christian prayer before graduation, telling students that they aren't good people if they don't believe in Jesus, things of that nature. So we have sued the school system in order to say, this is a violation of the First Amendment, and you can't do that. And it looks like, you know, so far, while it's not fully resolved, it looks like the school system is looking to revise its policies. But there, it has caused such a backlash. There is so much fear sort of among certain folks in the community who are the dominant religion about losing power, and that sort of very human feeling, I think, also of being threatened, you know, by being challenged, that our plaintiffs have received death threats from comments online, you know, can't wait for you to take a dirt nap, lots of different death threats. And we actually had to file a motion for their anonymity, because it's dangerous for them to be, you know, public faces, which is also a shame, because I think one of the things about this issue of separation of religion and government is we need to put a human face to it. We, you know, it can sound very legal and abstract at times. And there's not always a ready-made human face to put to it. There's another lawsuit that we brought in a town in Massachusetts that was giving public funds to restore the stained glass windows of a church as part of a historic mission. And the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, the highest state court, just came out and said, you can't do that. You know, you can't use public funds to restore sort of religious stained glass in a church. But again, you know, where's sort of the human face, the human harm? But there's lots of it is the answer. But we just want to make sure. I want to make sure that our group is putting front and center some of those human faces. You know, Charlie Craig and David Mullins in Colorado, who because a baker said his personal religious views trump the Colorado Civil Rights Public Accommodations Law. You know, their dignity is very harmed. And, you know, we need to make sure that when you do a Google search of the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, you don't just see the baker. You know, you see the couple who are being treated as second-class citizens.
So, and while these are important in humanizing, putting a face to the damage, it's really important, I think, even to step back and talk about the many countries around the world in which religion has been an instrument of national policy, in which there is no such separation, and the kinds of challenges that that poses. In other words, it is a slippery slope, isn't it?
Very much so. I mean, I am not an expert in, you know, other countries as much as I am in our ideal that we set forward in our very first amendment in this country. But basically, the beauty of the American experiment, and it's, you know, evident in the Declaration of Independence, is that, you know, we are all created equally, right? That's the secular way of saying, you know, we're all created in the image of God, which a lot of, but not all, religions believe. And you know, so in order for the American experiment to work, where we can all come together and have these freedoms and this liberty to be ourselves fundamentally. And of course, what you believe or not, or you don't believe, is one of the most personal aspects of who you are. And so in America, we come together and we say, you can be who you are fundamentally, and we're not going to make you a second-class citizen. In this country, you're equal. And if we put one religion into the government or into your state, or, you know, that sort of the dominant religion, you're not actually allowing everyone to have freedom of conscience and to be who they are. And in fact, you're imposing some other set of beliefs that, you know, or you're like in the case of school vouchers, and we actually have a thriving legislative affairs department as well at Americans United, both federally and across the states. We work a lot on the school vouchers issue. So for school vouchers, you're saying you're allowing taxpayer money to fund private schools where over 80% of that money goes to religious schools. So that, you know, what that isn't enabling us to live out the ideal of the American experiment.
I think it's important for our listeners to understand that this is not your organization, the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, is not doing anything to damage religion or religious belief or churches or synagogues or mosques or any other religious institution. It's working to protect everyone's access to all aspects of society.
I'm so glad that you said that. I think too often we are equated with being somehow anti-religion. And, you know, we are the best of America. We are people of faith. We are non-believers, atheists, humanists. We are people from the LGBT community and women. We are people of color who have experienced discrimination in the name of religion. Too often we are religious minorities, like Jews and Muslims and many other religious minorities. And we are Christians, and we are Christians of color, and we are white Christians, and we are Baptists, like the very folks like Roger Williams and John Leland, who are, you know, the first advocates in this country for the separation of religion and government, fierce advocates for that principle. So one of the things that's so lovely about the opportunity to lead a group like Americans United is the amazing medley of beautiful different faces that come together behind this important principle, because fundamentally it is an American principle that affects all of us.
I want to thank Rachel Laser for a great visit here on Too Jewish. She is the executive director of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, and the website is au.org, I believe.
Yes.
And where else could people go to find out more about you?
They'll find out a lot about me there. There's an amazing team effort of a rollout. There's a video, there are quotes about me, there's a Washington Post story, there's a blog. They'll be full by the time they finish reviewing that.
Soon to have a link to Too Jewish as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive.
This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be comedian and attorney Elliot Glicksman, talking about comedy and comedy for charity. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our play this morning comes from our Passover music collection, and it's my favorite ridiculous Pesach song of all, a definite way not to learn the real story of the Exodus from past two Jewish guests, Sean Altman's anti-historical version of the Seder story. They tried to kill us. We survived. Let's eat. My friends, may you have a Chag Sameach V'Kasher, a Zis and Pesach, a happy festival of freedom and matzah, and a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. The year was 1492. Hitler had just invaded Poland. Madonna had just become a Jew.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.